When I was talking with Stacy and we were putting together this series, this was actually a gap in the schedule. When I gave him the first list, I said, I don't know what I want to do on Monday night. And so I actually thought about it for a little while, and finally I thought, you know what, I'd like to just take a virtual walk through the Israel Museum, because there's a lot of things to see there. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And then, of course, my mind just didn't stop. I thought, you know what, I think I'd like to bring a few artifacts over and just let them see it. And then at that point, I thought, well, why stop there? And I want to introduce someone to you now. This gentleman sitting over here in the green shirt is Mr. Dan Kingsley. Dan and his wife, Paula, and three of their kids are here tonight. They actually have three more that aren't here with them. They have a total of six. Dan and Paula Kingsley live up in the Florence area, and we've been friends for a long time. And Dan and I have actually traveled a good bit together. And so when I told him I was going to be here and what I was going to do, and I thought I was going to bring some of my artifacts, I said, by the way, could you bring some of yours? And he immediately kind of bundled them up and brought them down here as well. And I couldn't be more happy for what he has brought. Actually, most of the things, I would say 75% of the things that you see here are actually things that Dan owns that we've been able to pick up in our travels. Dan and I have traveled a good bit together. And this year, for some reason, we really didn't plan it that way, but Dan and I think we have been to seven different countries just this year together. And that includes Muscle Shoals. And so it really just kind of ended up that way. Here's a picture that we took probably about 6 or 7 weeks ago of us in Paris, France. If we look a little haggard, it's because we are. We had flown overnight from Atlanta to Charles de Gaulle in Paris, I believe. And then we actually had a 12-hour layover in Paris and decided we didn't want to stay in the airport for 12 hours. So we actually got on a bus and rode a bus an hour from the airport into the city center so that we could go to the Louvre Museum and see a lot of things there. And so there's a number of biblical artifacts there as well. And so here we are in Paris. Here's a couple other pictures. The picture on the left was taken this last summer. We're standing in front of a Roman road in the city of Corinth, from the biblical city of Corinth over in Greece. The picture in right is taken that same week actually, from the top of a hotel in Istanbul, Turkey. The picture on the left, of course, is two of us that was taken about 7 or 8 weeks ago when we were in Egypt together. And the picture on the right is actually probably more representative of Dan and me than anything else. That's a picture of us in Israel. And we're sitting there ordering hamburgers from McDonald's. And so, but that's probably more representative of who Dan and I really, really are, if you really get down to it. But I appreciate Dan coming tonight. For those of you who worship here regularly, you know he and his family were here yesterday. I didn't realize they were going to be here. But I asked him to come and bring some of his things. And some of you have already come up and taken a look at these. And I invite you after the closing prayer, come on up. And Dan and I will be up here. We'll be happy to answer any questions about all these things. We have two sets of tables up here. This is a please touch table, and we sincerely mean that. You can pick up anything on this table and look at it. I wouldn't pick up the fire. But anything besides the fire you can pick up and look at it. And then over here we have things that please look. And a lot of these things are artifacts. I mean, some of the things on here are 3,000 years old that go from the time of King David. And so there's some really nice items over here. I will mention one item in particular over here, and it's this mud brick. And I'm gonna tell you the story about that. Dan and I were in Egypt, as I said, 7 or 8 weeks ago. And while we were there, we were able to go out in the country outside of Luxor, Egypt. And we went to an authentic hand brick making facility where they still hand make bricks out of mud and straw. And we were there with our team from Appian Media, so we were able to film some things to kind of get an idea of what the Israelites went through when they were there in Egypt. And when we left, they said, would you like a brick to take with you? And I'm not a big souvenir person, but I said, absolutely, I want a brick. Myself and Dan and two other guys on our team did that. Well, my schedule required for me to leave the team early, and I flew back. And so when I was by myself at the Cairo airport about midnight one night trying to check into a flight, And at most airports on the internationally, you have to put your bags through a x-ray machine just to get into the airport. And so I did that. And as soon as I did, the guy looked at me. He's like, and so I figured what it was. And he pulled me around the side and showed me a screen and says, "What is that?" I said, "It's a mud brick." And he says, "What?" I said, "It's a mud brick." And I said, "Do you want to see it?" And he said, "Yeah." So I pulled it out and showed it to him. And he said, "Why do you have this?" And I explained to him. I was down at Luxor. We were at this facility, and they offered me one. "I want to take it with me." He says, "Well, we're going to have to talk to my manager." So we go over to the manager. And I put it up there on the desk, and he looks at me and says, "What is that?" And I said, "It's a mud brick." But I explained to him the whole thing. I said, "You know, I'm a teacher." And I said, "I would love to take an authentic mud and straw brick back and to the United States." And he said, "Well, I'm going to have to make a couple phone calls." Long story, mine got confiscated. They wouldn't allow me to take it. They said it was of cultural significance. And it was, as I said, it was about midnight. And I really wasn't in the mood to argue with an Egyptian security officer. But what I wanted to say was, it can't be culturally, it didn't even exist a week ago. You know, so it can't be that culturally significant. But anyway, they took mine. But the other three guys that had theirs, they actually left Egypt via boat. But I texted them. I said, "Okay, mine got confiscated," but they were able to get theirs back to the United States. And so I'm really thrilled to see Mr. Brick here, because when I came home from my trip, Tab said, "How'd the trip go?" And I was like, "I lost my brick." And she's like, "What are you talking about?" And so anyway, but please, when we're done tonight, come up here and take a look at this. And a couple of people have asked if you can take pictures. You can absolutely take pictures. We'd love for you to do that. But enough about the Tri-Cities Museum. Let's talk about the Israel Museum. The Israel Museum is like any museum, big museum across the world. They're just huge. I mean, you could spend days in there. Those of you who've been to Washington, D.C. and tried to walk through some of those Smithsonian buildings, you know that. They're just huge. You could spend all kind of time there. But it's interesting, though. It's full of things that are related to the Bible. And I want to talk about this really quick before we stop that. Let me say a little bit about archaeology in Israel. It's very difficult to dig anywhere in Israel without digging something up. And there's just so much history in the ground. And I copied this story from the internet a couple of years ago, but it's a story about in Bethlehem. You know, during Jesus' time, it was just a small little town. It's not anymore. Tens of thousands of people live there, and like any other big city, they've got traffic problems. This is a story about a way to eliminate the traffic problems by building a tunnel underneath part of the city so the traffic could flow through there instead of having to go through the core of the city. And part of this article says this, and I realize it's too small to read, but it says, "And as is always the case when excavating in the Holy Land, any significant archaeological finds could hamper progress on the project. To circumvent that, the study proposes digging a tunnel no deeper than 11 meters or 33 feet. Anything of importance is usually buried farther down," according to Mazon Karom, the director of the Bethlehem Development Foundation, a group that helped draft the tunnel study. "What they're saying is that we need to build this tunnel, but we don't want to go too far down, because if we go too far down, we're going to find something. And the way it happens over there, as soon as you find something, everything stops. And the Israeli Antiquities Authority has to come in and take a look at it and see if they can continue with their project." A couple of examples. Across the street from the old city, Jerusalem has a parking problem as well and traffic problem as well. About 7 or 8 years ago, they were going to build a parking garage there just outside the old city, the Gavardi parking garage. Started digging, found artifacts and things. Well, since that time, the last 7 or 8 years, there's a huge archaeological dig there. I will tell you that there will never, ever, ever be a parking garage there. In fact, they still call it the Gavadi Parking Lot Archaeological Dig, but there will never be a parking lot there because of what they have found there. Just south of Jerusalem, on the way down to the Elah Valley, where David fought Goliath, Highway 35 goes through there. It's a bottleneck every time I've driven through there. It goes from 4-lane to 2-lane as you're going through the biblical city of Beth Shemesh. It goes to 2-lane. It's always a bottleneck, and they've been talking about trying to expand it to 4 lanes. About 3 years ago, they started to do that. Started digging. Guess what? They found more of the ancient city of Beth Shemesh, and so the project has completely stopped until they can finish all that. And that's what the guy's saying here is that, hey, we want to dig here, but there's just so much stuff in the ground that needs to be dug up. And so they're continuing to do that. But let's walk through the Israel Museum. I really want to take you to three different areas on here as quickly as I can. I want to take you over here to this first century model. There's a first century model of Jerusalem. And then I want to talk about the Shrine of the Book. The Shrine of the Book is where the Dead Sea Scrolls are located. And then finally, I want to go over here to the archaeological wing of the museum. And so we're going to kind of walk through that. So first of all, let's start off with the first century model. For many years, there was a model of the old city of the city of Jerusalem during the first century that was housed over at the Holy Land Hotel. And they were doing some renovations over there, and they decided to move that model to the Israel Museum. And I'm glad they did. This model is an incredible model of Jerusalem. And if you look really closely, you can see a gentleman standing right here. So that kind of helps you give you the scope of the size of this thing. It's probably about the size of two basketball courts. And it's an incredible model of what Jerusalem looked like during the first century. I would love to teach a class on one of the Gospels or Acts while you're standing around that thing. I tell you what would be really nice is if someone, some company, here's an idea for those of you who are business people, to recreate this on like a tabletop level. Because I would love for every congregation in the country to have one of these. It's absolutely fantastic. But you can see here, you can see the Kidron Valley coming down here to on the eastern side, and the Hinnom Valley over here down the south, and this huge area up here for the Temple Mount. I don't think we have a good appreciation for how the Temple Mount dominated the city of Jerusalem during the first century. You remember the disciples that, you know, none of them liked King Herod, but they tolerated him because of what they did for him, what they did for all of them. And one of the things he did was he refurbished their whole temple area. And the disciples were even proud of it. One time they told Jesus, they said, look at these beautiful buildings and these wonderful stones. I mean, they were proud of this, but it just dominated the skyline of Jerusalem. Here's a close-up of it, of what this would have looked like. The temple building itself, of course, is right here in the middle, but you see the colonnade areas that come all the way around. We get the information on what this looks like from not only from archaeology, but from writings of the time. Josephus was a famous Jewish writer, and he wrote a lot about what Jerusalem looked like, and especially this Temple Mount area. And they're able to use that information to recreate this huge model here. Here's kind of a close-up of what this would have looked like, looking straight on. In fact, from this vantage point on the model, this is what the city of Jerusalem would have looked like if you were standing on the Mount of Olives during the first century. And remember Jesus, there was a time in which he was on the Mount of Olives and looked over the city and wept over the city because he knew of what was going to happen. Here's kind of a close-up of the area here. This is called the Royal Stoa that's on the southern end of the Temple Mount. Tradition holds that maybe the Sanhedrin met. This is where the Sanhedrin would have met. When Jesus was in the temple area and he saw the money changers, that probably could have happened right here in the Royal Stoa area. Just north of the Temple Mount area, you have this building on the model. What is this building? Well, this is a representative of the Pools of Bethesda. And of course, we read in the story where Jesus healed a lame man at the Pools of Bethesda. And as it does so, it describes the pools. It says it had five porticos. And of course, that's exactly what they found when they dug in that area. There's one, two, three, four around the side. And then there's a fifth one that runs down the middle of the whole area. And of course, that's depicted on this model as well. Here's another area kind of looking toward the northeast across the city. And you can see the upper city here. This is where the elite of the city would have lived. And of course, the smaller buildings, this is going down to the lower part of the city. And of course, the huge Temple Mount area across there on the other side. This is a view looking directly east across the map. And I showed this for two reasons. One is on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount was this Roman barracks, army barracks that were there. It's called the Antonio Fortress. And so that's where the Roman soldiers would be. If you remember when Paul was arrested on the Temple Mount, we'll reference that story here in a little bit. They actually took him over to the Antonio Fortress area and he spoke to the people from there. But I also show this because this area right here, depicted outside the city, is the location of Golgotha, the traditional location of Golgotha. And if you remember from the scriptures, it said that it was nigh to the city. It was very close to the city, but it was outside the city walls. And of course, that's depicted right here in this area. For those of you who were here yesterday, and I showed pictures of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that church now sits on top of that location currently. So that's kind of a quick walk around of this first century model. It's an incredible thing to see. It's one of those things that whenever I take a group there, I tell them, I said, you cannot take too many pictures at this location. I probably have, I don't know, 500, 600, 700 pictures of that model in my files. And when I'm teaching a class on the Gospels, I will invariably not have the exact angle that I'm looking for. And so I don't know how that always happens, but it certainly does. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is the Shrine of the Book. And before we walk into the Shrine of the Book, I want to describe to you a little bit about what the Dead Sea Scrolls are. Most of you know what they are, but they were found here in mid-1940s, late 1940s, here in Qumran. Qumran is a site that sits on the northwest corner of the Dead Sea area. And in fact, you can see one of the caves here where these were found. But if you stand right there and turn around 180 degrees and face due east, what you see is this. And you're looking out across the Dead Sea over to the hills of, well, it's modern day Jordan, but we would call this Moab from the time of the Bible. And I don't know what you've ever pictured in your mind about what the Dead Sea looks like, but actually the Dead Sea is very beautiful. The water is, in a lot of ways, it's almost crystal clear blue. But it has, you know, with the high salt content, nothing can live there, so that's why it's called the Dead Sea. As I said, these are the hills of Moab. This high peak right here, you see with a few trees on top, is actually Mount Nebo, where Moses went there just before he died to look over the country before the Israelites were able to go in and conquer it. But turning back around, this is more of the Qumran area. You can see some of the caves right here. And if you're familiar with the story, a Bedouin shepherd found these scrolls in some pots and eventually took them to a gentleman by the name of Kando, who lives in Bethlehem. In fact, he took him to this gentleman right here. He recognized that these were of some significance, but he wasn't exactly sure what they were and was able to send the Bedouins back out, and they acquired more of these. He eventually turned those over to the Israeli authorities because Israel had just become a country at that point. And they quickly analyzed them and figured out what they were. And of course, what they were was a number of documents written in the first century BC. About 25% of those documents are actually copies of the Bible. And we'll talk about the significance of that in a minute. The other 75% were other documents that they were used in their community. But he recognized what they were. The Israeli government was so thankful for what he had done that they did a couple of things, but the main thing was they gave the Kando family the very first antiquities license in the state of Israel. And that license has passed down through the family, and now his grandsons run a store in Bethlehem. The gentleman there on the right is one of the grandsons. His name is Shibley Kando, and he actually he's a really smart man. He's getting his PhD from one of the Ivy League schools right now, and he actually travels to the United States a good bit. And a lot of times I enjoy taking my tour group there because it's interesting to let him, the grandson, kind of tell the story. But they have a very nice shop here in Bethlehem. As you can see, they have a lot of nice things to sell. And a lot of antiquities. In fact, I would say a good percentage of what's sitting up here on this table came from Kando and his shop there. They have a lot of olive wood carving things there. You can buy a little camel for $10, or you can buy a huge thing about this big for $50,000, whatever you want. He's got it, and he'll be happy to sell it to you. I haven't actually asked what the shipping on that big old thing is. I can't afford the 50 grand, so I'm sure the shipping is not even a relevant question. But one of the other reasons why I like to go here is because they have this jar here. One of the gifts that the Israeli government gave to the family was this jar. This was the jar, actually, that the Isaiah scroll was found in. There are only four intact, completely intact, Dead Sea Scroll jars that are on display in the world. There's one at the Vatican, and there's two in the Israel Museum at the Shrine of the Book, but you're not allowed to take pictures of any of those three, but you can take as many pictures as you want of this one. And so I like going here and letting people see this. As you would expect, this is very valuable. The last time I spoke to him about it, he and his family have been offered $16 million for this jar. But of course, they don't want to let it go for a number of reasons. But it sits here at his store in Bethlehem. So let me talk for a second about why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so important. They're important because we are sitting over here in 2000 BC. Here's a timeline from 2000 BC to 2000 AD. We're sitting over here in 2022 AD. And the events of the writings of the Old Testament took place, and it's kind of hard to see, you can kind of see where I've highlighted right here. This is where the events in the writings of the Old Testament took place. And so we have our Bible sitting here 2,000 years later. And what we would like to know is what we have in our Bible, what was written back at those times? Because that's very important. We need for our Bibles to match what was originally written. And so we want that to happen. Same way with the New Testament. Now, the New Testament, the events took place over just a series of decades in the first century. But the same thing. We want to make sure that what we have in our Bible matches what was written, because that's important. Well, as they've gone through time, there are actually a number of copies. I have them denoted here by little orange dots. There's a number of copies of the Old Testament and the New Testament that go back to the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century AD. And so we check what's in our Bible versus those copies, and guess what? On the Old Testament, they check out. And on the New Testament, they check out. That's great. For the New Testament, we're talking about copies that are only a couple hundred years from the original, so that's pretty good. But over here on the Old Testament side, you're still looking at a difference of 700 or 800 years between when the at least the last ones were written and the copies that we have. Well, that's where the Dead Sea Scrolls came in, because the Dead Sea Scrolls were written here in the first century BC, and so what we were able to do is take that line on the Old Testament side and go back even farther, and we can compare our Bibles to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which dated to the first century BC, and guess what? They still checked out. It's the what we have in our Bible matches exactly what they had back there in those scrolls. And so that's good. That helps us to appreciate and have confidence that what we have in our Bibles is exactly what was written and inspired by those men. Very, very important. So let's go to the Shrine of the Book. This is what it looks like from the outside. This is it's an underground museum. They put the top of it here to kind of look like the top of a jar. And so what you do is you go in there, and when you get inside, it looks like this. And there's all kind of documents all around. You can see all these here. And of course, the middle part here is made to look kind of like a scroll. And what they have here in the middle is actually the scroll of the prophet Isaiah that goes all the way around. And you can take a look at that. This is a place where, you know, any dignitaries go. This is a picture of taken a few years ago when President Obama visited Jerusalem. And the gentleman in the gray hair here is their prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He wasn't the prime minister, but now he's prime minister again. So he kind of goes in and out. But as I said, famous people go there all the time. As I said, we weren't allowed to take pictures in there, but we were able to, when we were over there with the Appian Media team, we were able to get permission, i.e. we bought a permit, to take some pictures in there. Here's a picture of Jeremy and myself looking at the Isaiah scroll. And here's a close-up of what that scroll looks like. It's actually really, really impressive, especially being as old as it is. If you can read ancient Hebrew, you could read right through this. And so it's kind of a beautiful thing to see. Okay, I want to spend the last bit of our time here walking through the archaeological museum. This museum has just thousands of artifacts, and I brought a picture of every single one. Now, I want to show you a few things, and then we're going to look at a few things specifically and kind of talk about them, and then the lesson will be yours. But it's still going to be in just a little while, so just hang in there with me. There's a number of things in this museum. I'm just going to kind of go through a few pictures quickly here. These are some sarcophaguses from the Gaza area, as you can see. They kind of have an Egyptian influence to them. Very, very beautiful. Here's some pottery that dates back to biblical times. You can see the one there on a rope. The idea is that you would pour the milk and whatever you need to make cheese and butter and put it in there and then use the ropes to kind of rock the thing back and forth while it churns. They're very, very proficient in the things that they did. Here's just a pot. You can see it was broken when they found it, but they've been able to repair it. If you wanted to grind meal, here's a little stone basin with a grinder, so you could grind meal that could be used in making bread. Here's another large pot. This pot is probably 2 feet tall. That you see here. All these things are things that from biblical times. This is a little bottle with some currency in there. Here's some currency that'd be used to trade for goods and services during that time. Here's another sarcophagus. I talked a little bit yesterday about King Herod. King Herod had a number of palaces across the land when he lived there. He had a palace in Jericho, and he had the palace in Jericho because, as we learned yesterday, it's warmer in Jericho, so it was his winter palace. And in fact, King Herod died in Jericho, and his body was taken from there up to the Herodium, just south of Bethlehem, to another palace that he has built. And excavation work from there, they dug this up, and they believe this is the sarcophagus of King Herod, Herod the Great, that was found there at the Herodium. So what I want to do now is I want to show you seven or eight little things here, but I want to look at it from the perspective of the Bible. And so I want to open up and read a few passages here. In Jeremiah, the 34th chapter, Jeremiah is writing about the incoming and ongoing attack of the Babylonians on the southern kingdom of Judah. And in verse 7 he says, let's start in verse 6, "Then Jeremiah the prophet spoke all these words to Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem, when the army of the king of Babylon was fighting against Jerusalem and against all the cities of Judah that were left, Lachish and Azekah, for these are the only two fortified cities of Judah that remain." So what Jeremiah is saying here is that the Babylonians are coming in, and right now, outside of Jerusalem, there are only two fortified cities left, and they're Lachish and Azekah. One of the things that you see in the Israel Museum are about 20 ostracon. Ostracon are little clay pieces of clay that have writing on them. These are called the Lachish letters. So what are the Lachish letters? Well, they were letters written from a soldier located in Judah and written to his commander who was in Lachish. And most of the letters are of a personal nature. They're talking about just personal things. But letter number 4, one of the interesting things about that letter was at one point he says, "I'm waiting for guidance from you, O captain, because I can no longer see the signal fires from Azekah." And so you have to think about that in relationship to this passage that we read here in Jeremiah, the 34th chapter. Jeremiah wrote this, there were two cities that were left, Azekah and Lachish. And this letter was written by a soldier and writing to his commander who's in Lachish, and he says in the letter, "I can no longer see the signal fires from Azekah." Meaning Azekah has fallen to the Babylonians. And it gives a perspective of what was going on in the land. A lot of times we talk about, well, the Babylonians came in and captured the southern kingdom of Judah. And that's exactly right. But what happened there was much longer than one sentence. This was decades of the Babylonians being in the land, taking city after city after city after city. And soldiers like this man who wrote this is watching city after city after city for years fall. And now out of desperation, he's writing a letter saying, I need help. I need guidance. I can no longer see the signal fires from Azekah. We're going downhill. It's just one of these things that is related to the Bible, but just makes the Bible, you know, kind of become real a little bit. Let's look at John, the second chapter. In John, the second chapter, we have one of the miracles of Jesus. Beginning in verse 1, it says, on the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. There were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. And of course, we know what happened. Jesus then turned that water into wine. In the Israel Museum, they have a number of first century stone water jars. These jars are probably about 3 feet tall, and they hold 20 to 30 gallons, just like what we read in the scripture. Now, these aren't the same water ones that we just read about in John, the second chapter, but these are the type that they're talking about. And so whenever you read that story in the future, I hope that you think about this picture here, because this is what they're referring to when they're talking about this story. Let's look at 2 Kings 18. In 2 Kings 18, we have a story about Hezekiah. We talked a little bit about Hezekiah yesterday. Beginning in verse 1, it says, in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. He removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel had made offerings to it. So we read in this passage and in other passages about Hezekiah that he went in and utterly destroyed these worship places that the people had been using in their pagan rituals. In the Israel Museum, they found this altar, and it has since been rebuilt, and it's in display in the Israel Museum. But when they found it, it was completely broken. It had been broken apart. This altar dates to the time of Hezekiah, and because it was all broken, it was in an area where there was a worship center, and it had been completely destroyed, and it reflects directly back to the passage that we just read here in 2 Kings. Let's talk for a second about King David. King David, for a long time, by skeptics, they thought, they said, what you read in the Bible about King David is not entirely accurate. I mean, what you read in the Bible is the fact that the kingdom of Israel is growing in size, and David being a very popular man with the people and with the nations all around. And that was in time of incredible growth with the United Kingdom of Israel. But skeptics would look at that and say, no, you know, I don't think that's accurate. Mostly because there's no archaeology to back up David. You know, he wasn't a ruler over a large kingdom. He was maybe a tribal leader or something like that. Well, that all changed in 1993. Up around the city of Dan, they found this stone. Actually, they found one of these stones the last dig day of the dig season in 1993. And then the very first day in 1994, they found the second stone. Then they combined them together. So what is this stone? The stone is called the Tel Dan Stele. Now, what's written on there is an account of a story that we read about in the Bible. You remember the story when King Hazael was battling against Israel and Judah, and Israel and Judah had kind of combined forces because at the time the kings were semi-related in a way. And Jehu then was named as a king, and he came back and he killed both the king of Judah and the king of Israel as he took the throne. Well, this is an account of that same story told from King Hazael's point of view. And in this story, he takes credit for those two deaths. Now you think, well, wait a minute, he wasn't even in the area. Why does he take credit for it? Well, he takes credit for it because he's a political leader. And political leaders try to take credit anywhere they can if they think it'll help them. And I guess from his vantage point, he might have an argument, because the reason these two guys were where they were at the same place was because they were in battle against him. And so maybe the presence of this battle is what eventually caused these two guys to die. But what's interesting about this is this was written by King Hazael. And in here, he's telling the story, and he refers to Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, as Israel. But he doesn't refer to Judah as Judah. He refers to it as the house of David, which was very interesting because King Hazael lived 150 years after King David died. And King Hazael is a foreign leader. He has no reason to refer to a foreign country as the house of somebody, house of David. He has no reason to do that. But he did anyway. And what it shows is that even 150 years later, after David had died, King David's knowledge and the respect that even the foreign nations had for David still existed, which gave credibility to what we read in the Bible, that he was a much more powerful leader than the skeptics were admitting. And so this was an incredible find, and quite frankly, really shut down that argument, because the main tent pole that they were holding onto was the fact that there was no archaeological evidence of David's existence. And then this just kind of quieted that up. And so again, what we read in the Bible is accurate. Let's look at 2 Chronicles 26. In 2 Chronicles 26, we have a story of King Uzziah. Of King Uzziah. And a very interesting story that happens to him at the very end of his reign. Beginning in verse 16, it says, "But when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction. For he was unfaithful to the Lord his God, and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. But Azariah the priest went in after him, with 80 priests of the Lord who were men of valor, and they withstood King Uzziah and said to him, 'It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong, and it will bring you no honor from the Lord God.' Then Uzziah was angry, and he had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And when he became angry with his priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. And Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous on his forehead. They rushed him out quickly, and he himself hurried to get out, because the Lord had struck him. And King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and being a leper, lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord." So we have this story here, King Uzziah not doing what he should have been doing, and God called him on it, and God struck him with leprosy, and he died with leprosy. A number of years ago, they found this sign in Jerusalem. Now, this sign dates to the first century, and I'll explain that in just a minute. This sign says, "Hither were brought the bones of Uzziah, king of Judah, not to be opened." That's interesting. You know, why was this not to be opened? Well, first of all, it's a dead man's grave. You just don't open a dead man's grave. But more than that, this was the bones of a dead king. You especially don't want to open royalty, the bones of royalty. But of course, there's probably a third reason why you would not want to open up this grave. It was leprous. You would not want to open up this grave. And so, as I said, apparently at some point around the first century, Uzziah's bones were moved from wherever it was buried to this location, and they made this sign and put it up there. And it says, here's King Uzziah. Don't open this grave. And of course, that relates directly to the story that we read about here. Let me talk just a second about Ketif Hinnom. Ketif Hinnom is a Hebrew name, and it literally means shoulder of Hinnom. You know, you're aware that the Hinnom Valley runs on the southern edge of the city of Jerusalem, and there's a rocky outcrop on the western side of it called the shoulder of Hinnom, Ketif Hinnom. And a number of years ago, an archaeologist by the name of Gabriel Barkai, Dan and I actually had the opportunity to meet him a couple of years ago, was digging there. And while digging, he found this. These are two metal scrolls. And they're very small. I mean, that larger one is probably you know, 3 inches high. And it was rolled up when they found it. And it took several years to figure out how to unroll it. And it was probably worn on a necklace around a woman's neck. But when they unrolled it, there was writing on the inside. And they looked at the writing, and turns out the writing was from Numbers, the 6th chapter, the priestly blessing that's written there. And so what's interesting about this is that this is the oldest known copies of Scripture. We talked a minute ago about the Dead Sea Scrolls. They date to the 1st century B.C. Well, this dates to about the 8th century B.C. These scrolls are 600 to 700 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, this is only three verses, so it's not a very large part of our Scripture, but it's very, very interesting just to see that. Let's talk about Caiaphas for a second. We all know who Caiaphas is. Caiaphas was the high priest. When Jesus was going through his trials, one of the first trials that Jesus went through was at the high priest's house at Caiaphas. A number of years ago, they found this bone box, this ossuary in Jerusalem. So first of all, what is an ossuary? An ossuary is, as I said, it's a bone box. During the first century, when Jewish people died, they would wrap the body up in cloths, anoint it with oil, and then bury the body. This is what they were in the process of doing to Jesus when, you know, as he died. They would come back after about a year or so, once the body has completely decomposed, and then they would take the bones that were left and place them in a bone box and then rebury that person. This bone box, as you can see, is extremely ornate. It's got all the carvings on the sides, really beautifully done. So this is somebody of some importance to have a bone box like this. And on the edge of the box, you may be able to see handwriting. Here's a little close-up. And this went through a number of different analysis for years. But archaeologists now believe that this is the bone box of Caiaphas the high priest, the man that we read about with regards to the trials of Jesus. And it was a beautiful, beautiful find and something worthy of us looking at. And let me talk for a second about Pontius Pilate. And this was another character used in the trials of Jesus. In the city of Caesarea a number of years ago, they found this stone. This stone was used as like a memoriam to a new building. They're not exactly sure, but you know, they dedicated a new building and they put this stone up. During the first century, Caesarea was the Roman administrative capital of that area. You know how when you go from here, if you fly through anywhere, you go through Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta. If you lived in the first century and lived in that area of the world, you went through Caesarea. That's why Paul went through Caesarea on all his travels. This is where the Roman administrative capital was. And when they found this stone, it actually identifies Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, as one of the men who are leaders. And of course, that aligns directly with what we read in Scripture. Let's look at Acts 21. I promise. Hang in there just another minute. We only have a couple more of these. Acts 21, we have this story that I actually referenced a little while ago of Paul. Paul, beginning in verse 27, it says, "When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, 'Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and against the law and against this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place.' For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." This is a close-up of that model I showed you a minute ago. Now, when we read the word temple in the Bible, we sometimes have to read it in context. Sometimes when you read the word temple, it's talking about this physical building right here. But sometimes it's talking about the temple complex. I referenced earlier about Jesus overturning the money tables. Said he did that in the temple. Well, he probably did not do that inside this physical building. It was within the temple complex. And the same thing applies to here. Paul was accused of taking Trophimus into the temple. Well, he probably didn't. They probably weren't accusing him of taking him into the temple itself. They were probably accusing him of taking Trophimus from the court of the Gentiles into the court of the Jews. Now, on this model here, the division between the court of the Gentiles and the court of the Jews is depicted by this small wall that goes around the temple building. That wall was called a soreg. That's what it was called. And around that wall, all the way around, was this sign. This is from the Israel Museum. This was a sign that was posted there on the soreg. And here's what this sign says. It says, "No foreigner shall enter within the forecourt and balustrade around the sanctuary. Whoever is caught will have himself to blame for his subsequent death." They're direct about the crime and the punishment here. But this relates to the story that we read about here in Acts, the 21st chapter, about Paul being accused of taking Trophimus into the court of the Jews. Okay, that's it. I'll release you at this point. But I appreciate so much your kind attention tonight. You've just been wonderful, and I really do appreciate it. I realize that we covered a lot of information tonight. And as I said, I guess in a threatening way, I could have stand up here for several more hours and showed you things from the Israel Museum. But let me tell you really quickly why this is important. This is important because the places in the Bible are real. And the people that we read about in the Bible are real. And the things that we read about in the Bible are real. And the events that we read about in the Bible are real. And those things are backed up by history and archaeology. And we can see that. But here's the important question. Is once you've studied it, and once you know, and once you recognize that the places and the people and the things and the events of the Bible are real, you've got a question to ask yourself. And that is, what are you going to do with that information? Because you have to make a decision. Do you believe it or do you not? All of us would love for you to believe this information and change your life so that you act upon that. If there's anyone here in the audience that wants to make their life right and come to Jesus, we ask you to come to the front.